E-commerce isn't just an aspect of growing a successful wine business, it is crucial. And that's why I strongly recommend working with Offset Partners. As a proudly independent e-commerce technology and brand design company based in wine country, Offset understands the operational nuances and the customer service imperatives that distinguish a great online buying experience from a mediocre one. And that's why leading and legendary brands like Saxum, Arnott Roberts, and Kermit Lynch Wine Merchant choose Offset's proprietary commerce technology platform to power their DTC sales. If you're an allocated winery or a high-touch merchant that values an elegant, effective commerce solution for both you, your customers, and your team, reach out to the smart team at offsetpartners.com. That's OFFSET, partners with an S.com, to craft a better direct-to-consumer experience. I'll drink to that, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. Russell Hone on the show today, aubergiste for Becky Wasserman Company. Hello, sir. How are you?
Okay.
So you were born in 1944.
Yes.
And your mother was a really good cook.
Yes, she was trained at the Doe School in Aberdeen and then came down and taught in London and ended up teaching in Cheltenham as governor of the North Gloucestershire Technical College and training chefs.
But this was during the war years and then the post-war years where there was rationing of food.
Rationing lasted until in England until the mid-50s, which was crazy. Far longer than should have been necessary. I remember seeing a newsreel later about how bananas in 1947, the first boat that arrived in Liverpool, and people going berserk.
Your parents had German friends.
I had started 12 or 13 going to Germany, doing an exchange with a family called von Lüttichau Bernstein, and there were four boys. The eldest, Bernhard, was same age as me. And he had a sort of farm around a modern sort of villa. And I used to have fun driving the Volkswagen when he went out at night with a rifle to shoot deer.
Did you speak German as a kid?
I didn't learn German until I went after school, having failed to pass into Oxford, like my elder brother. And he suggested I did something useful, which was to go to a Goethe Institute and learn German. So I went in 63 to Bad Reichenhall, which is just over the border from Salzburg, and stayed 6 months doing the Goethe Institute language course. I came back and took the Oxford things again, failed, and then took on a course at external London University degree, which was at the LSE. And I thought it, would be academic. Then decided it was a waste of time. And during the course of that, had been working for a woman, Rennie Goddard, at ATV as script supervisor, which was sussing out whether the scripts that were being submitted for the soaps, whether the characters fitted in, because different people were writing different sections. So you didn't want the character of Mr. X changing from a raving murderer from one to a country vicar in the next. And that was the thing. But then couldn't get employed because the union stepped in and said they had to be a union appointment. And one of those things in those days, how do you get work in the union if you're not allowed to be employed? And from there was hired to a advertising company making advertising films and things. And along the line there did a Coburn's Port and Harvest Bristol Cream ad, and thought, why not do something in the wine trade? Spoke French, spoke German, must be useful. Thinking drink. And along the line met a guy called Fred May, who said, I'll take you on for a 3-month trial. And then if I like you, I'll send you to Germany because you know nothing about wine. And which is perfectly true. I knew the shape of the bottles vaguely. And some were red and some were white. But at home, we hadn't drunk that much red until my brother went to Oxford. But I remember somewhere along the line, I was probably about 12, and finding half-drunk bottles out by the dustbins and so and so, and swinging down and liking it quite a lot. And I do remember, for some curious reason, it was Alox Courton 53, bottled by Joe Lyons and Company, and thought, oh, this is quite good. But the only other thing I drank during the time was pinching wine from port decanter. And my father had 27 Taylor and 27 Sandeman, 1908, I remember the famous Coburn 08. I used to take swills from that. Luckily, the heavy cut glass I was able to drink and not be found out because they couldn't see the level of the decanter.
And so you were off to Germany once again, but this time in the wine trade.
Yeah, that was in 69, having just got married. Went to Germany. I started with Adolf Reinhard Schmitzerner down at Longüch, and then to the Priester Seminar in Trier, and then to S.A. Prüm in Weilen, and then to Schlossvorratz, and then finally to Wachenheim with Birkelin Wolf.
What was Wollrand's like at that time?
Very good stuff. They used to bottle up in the courtyard, and you used to shoot the bottles down on a sort of back of a buggy, like a sort of stripped-down Jeep. And then you had to slide the bottles down a long flight of steps and then scurry along to the end of the cellar and build the wall of bottles. So it was very exhausting, but luckily it was only one day that that happened. But very good. And I remember visiting Johannesburg, and Johannesburg was surprisingly, bits of black stuff would fall on your head as we were going around. And I said to Chardonnay, what is this? And he said, well, in these casks, they don't keep wine in them anymore. The wine is all kept out back in Kunststoff tank and fiberglass tanks. And these wooden barrels are there for show. And so the Schimmelpilz is dying. You know, the mold from the cellar has died from lack of fumes to keep it alive. And so then, Schloss Johannesburg, no good.
That was right at that time when the Rheingau started to go down and the other regions started to go up.
Well, it was very difficult selling and people not getting enough money for doing stuff. We sold quite a lot. Fred May, we imported a lot and so, by anybody's standards. But the major market, of course, was for the crap like Liebfraumilch and all that sort of sweet junk. There was a thing from the Moselle called Himmlisches Moseldrops and Heavenly Moseldrops that sold something like 8 million bottles or something a year. But fine German wine was sort of dying a bit.
What are your memories about the old German wines?
If the cork has survived and it's been well stored and so, you get amazing old German wine. Not just the super stickies. You open things, say, from the 60s and 70s, which are not anything more than Spätlese, and they're still pretty good. The 21s I remember producing for a Cambridge Don who was very much into German wine. I found a 21 Sichel Blue Nun Auslese. And after we'd had this huge tasting or lunch with Vintage Madeiras, I gave him a quick slug of this and he said, oh, it's got to be the 21. And just pang like that, you know.
What other vintages of German wines are you fond of?
49, 53s were beautiful. 59s were beautiful and, you know, sweet things and so. In the 60s, 64, Moselle 64, 66, 71, great vintage. A changeover with the German wine laws and everything, it didn't F it up. 75s were actually good in the Mosel. Much more acidity and so. 76s for stickies.
And what was Mr. May like?
Quite a tough boss. He'd had, a rough passage. He came over to England with having joined the Pioneer Corps, he said, to get out of Canada. He'd been interned in Canada. He said it was so bloody cold, he'd do anything. So I think came over and worked with the British Army in Germany, either, you know, finding out who were Nazis or who weren't, and various unsavory jobs like burying corpses and things like that that happened after the war. But he was very mean in terms of payment and stuff, but he was a very good teacher, and he let me sort of get on with it. I was supposed to go to Bordeaux, but when I came back from Germany, I was briefly in Bordeaux, just beginning of 1970, before the 70 vintage, and a salesman had to have an eye cataract operation, so I was pushed out onto the road and had to cut my teeth. Selling, and we sold, I was Bull's Blood, a Tokai, a Balatoni Riesling, and handing out samples to ladies in supermarkets, and say, "Oh, Bull's Blood, maybe it'll give my old man a fillip or something, you know, get him going." Then, "No, madam, you know, definitely," and says, "But if you really want to get him going, give him a bottle of this Tokai. That will really, really get him excited."
The Petunios effect.
Yeah.
So, at some point around that time, you had this idea that maybe the colleges would be good to sell to.
Absolutely. What happened was, I said, "Look, my brother had been at Oxford," and then I said, "Why don't I try and sell some wine to colleges?" I knew that there were other companies doing this, one called Dollamore's, and there was then O.W. Loeb, and so and so. And so that started, and I was very successful because they were buying a mass of better but cheaper sort of German, and a lot of fine as well, because they would sometimes serve it with dessert, which means fruit and nuts, basically, after dinner. They also served lots for, you know, parties and entertainment and stuff like that. That was fun, and also being able to talk to intelligent, you know, they wanted to pump me for info on wine, and I'd pump them on info on their subjects.
You attempted the MW exam in 76, and you passed tasting.
Yeah, I was 75 or 76, I forget which, and I passed the tasting part, and I decided not to take it again, because there was a very silly question about the percentages of acids and so in wines and grape varieties before and after fermentation, and a clue. So I wrote, "I'm not a bloody chemist." And so they said, "Well, I think you should be excused from taking the exam again." And I said, "Well, that's fine, because I'm not going to."
When did you lead the tasting where the gentleman died?
Oh, that was while I was working for FNMA. There was a tasting club in North London, and I was asked to give a tasting on Burgundy. I do remember that one of the bottles was a Magnum of 55 Charme Chambertin bottle by Berry Brothers, and I was asked to give a talk, and then we would go for dinner afterwards. And so got there, opened up the wines, checked them out, and so, and then I was up on the stage behind a lectern, and I started my speech by saying, "As you all know, Burgundy is in the Middle East of France and so, below Champagne and north of Lyon, if you take Beaujolais up to Chablis and da, da, da." And at this point, I heard somebody making a sort of noise. And I thought, oh, somebody is saying, "Oh, get on with it. You're wasting time. And of course, we know this and so." And I started to smile, because I saw the people in front of me smiling down on the thing, and then suddenly the sound got more sort of, and then I saw their faces fall, and then they realized so-and-so was having a heart attack, so they had to stop tasting. The ambulance came and took him away. And then it was voted, they had to take a vote on whether the thing should be totally abandoned or whether they should go on with the tasting. And they said, "Well, as the wines have been opened, we're not going to leave them." And I said, "Well, I'm not going to talk. I'm sorry after this. You can get on with the tasting," and says, "and count me out." And anyway, that's what happened. And apparently the poor guy died on the way to the, I never met him before, on the way to the hospital. And we went on with the dinner as well, which was also, cheers to old Harry and so. It was quite macabre. Very unusual.
Next, you worked for Lafite Concord.
Yep. Concord had this, I'd been to Bordeaux, but I said, "You do something in Burgundy," and so, okay. Went out at the end of January. Clive Coates was buyer for British Transport Hotels, and I hitched a ride out and met Jean-Pierre Nier, who was boss of the, just been hired 3 months before to head up Concar Perry Fils, as it was called then. It's now the Compagnie des Vins d'Autrefois. And I saw on his desk there was a list of old wines going back to 06 Montrachet. And I said, what's this? And he said, oh, it's just old garbage being sold by a wholesaler down in Gurnion, sort of 100 kilometers south of here. And I said, this is old stuff. This is serious. Are they any good? And he said, I haven't bothered. And I said, well, go down and see it. And both of us had a fiendish cold and so, but we got down there. And the wines were in an absolutely perfect cellar. There was all bins and bin numbered and everything, and lots of the old cellar mold. So you can taste whatever you like. So I'll have the 06 Montrachet. And so the cellar man would go and check on his list and go back to the bin, and came and we wiped them off and tasted and said, these are fantastic. And I went rushing back, scuttling back to England, saying, this is very good. I went to Michael Broadbent and said, would you sell these things? It isn't a huge quantity, but the wines are very serious. And he said, okay. And because I knew the news editor at the time, he's one, and I said, you know, this is a thing. And so he sent out, the Guardian sent out Martin, somebody, and wrote an article on the front page of the Guardian, going, liquid gold retrieved from the cobwebs, and a sort of murky photograph. Hey, you know, don't make the front page of the Guardian every day. And they said, we published the story because it was a nice story to publish instead of a nasty story. You know, it wasn't sort of, you know, three women murdered in a black cab. It was a nice story. And it went into a sale in June and so, and prices were not spectacular because it was an unknown name. You know, it wasn't a well-known negotiant or anything. And there were some Auspice wines, 45, 47, and this 06 and 35, shall I say, but in very good condition. And I had to convince the company to buy the stuff. So Clive said, if you say they're all right, I'll buy them. You know, I've been tasting with you for years and so. He'd been my coach for the MWs. He said, oh, I'll take five cases of this for the Malmaison Wine Club. And the best thing he ever did, there was a chunk of Hermitage going for £3 a bottle. 1929 Hermitage, which was sensational. And there were about 10 or 12 cases of that. I regret not sort of... So to convince the Concar people that it was worth buying, I sort of outrageously high 300, 400, 500% of prices that persuaded them to then buy the rest of the stock, and then we put the rest into Christie's. That was a fun thing. I was let go, as they say, by Concar 80-81 that started working for Loeb because they wanted somebody to replace Anthony Goldthorpe, who'd been selling to the colleges, and so they knew that I was respected by the college people, and so was asked to join. And it took a long time to sort of decide, and I did, and found very old-fashioned ways and difficulty in kind of fitting in. Certain things that I said, you really shouldn't be selling these. I said, we should really send back the 77 Rousseaux because of the haze. They're completely impossible to do it. There was a theory. Charles Rousseau thought that bottles hadn't been properly washed.
The 77 Rousseaux were cloudy that year.
Yeah, they were cloudy. And you could not get them clear, even with coffee filter things. And when I heard that Wildman had sent them back, I said to Loeb, you know, you should really send them back. But they didn't want to sort of upset Charles and so. So had the job of trying to sell them, which was quite impossible. They weren't that bad to taste, but they were just totally murky.
What was Loeb like as a company?
The original company was founded by Otto Loeb, who came over as a refugee in the 1930s. He also had a company called Loeb & Steinlein in Trier. And so we had a whole swathe of German wines. then they came sort of rather later to Burgundy when David Dugdale took over, bought the company, it was floundering, and they did a tiny bit of Bordeaux. I remember they got some Parma, but they had a very curious thing. They used to not offer anything for sale until they got it over. So when in 1982, they bought stuff on Primeur, but they wouldn't sort of sell. And very quickly, prices, you know, sort of tripled for the 82s, you know, demand from the States, and same very, very hot. And I said, why don't you, you know, sell some now instead of waiting to, you know, ship it for a year or thing and so on. So anyway, I was not on the board of decision. And I sort of was a bit sort of irritating. And when I wasn't supposed to go and taste the 82s with them, but one of their ex-partners, Frank Laws Johnson, who'd been banker in Paris, had a fantastic cellar. I was asked to drive him down to join Mr. and Mrs. Dugdale and Goldthorpe and his wife on their buying trip in the 82s. Because we used to buy a lot of Petit Chateau, which colleges and things bought a lot of. So at the last moment, I was called to drive him down. And it was 83 when when the riots were on. And so my car, which was a French Peugeot estate, was broken into first night and everything taken, which included a whole string of Krug and a mini vertical of Leo Lascasse that I got from my old company from Concar. And then the following night, the thing was broken into again and dog shit smeared all over the door handles and everything, which wasn't very nice. You know, revolting students and all that. And I was told that I wasn't to expect to go to any of the dinners. And so I fixed up one night to go to supper with Jean-Eugène Vory at Duc Rivacaille. But when the war drums had beaten and they were told that I was there, your young man must join us for dinner. So you must come to this dinner. So I blew off Jean-Eugène and said, I'm terribly sorry, but I duty calls and so on. So he said, that's where I'd come and taste the wines first and then go a bit late to your dinner. And then turned up, and what really put noses out of joint was that all the people were there who I knew terribly well from having worked for Concar. So there was the people from Moreau's, people from Lafon Roche, and things. Oh, Russell. I did not go down a treat when the star of the show should be the bosses, you know. You have to be very careful. And I wasn't. And also, when you guess things right and they don't, and so, that not a good thing. Not very diplomatic.
You worked on a book series with Richard Olney.
He was doing the Good Cook series, and he wanted somebody to scout for wine for him when in London, because it was all filmed and shot in London. And so I was put on to him by somebody, and we became very good friends, and so helped him buy old stuff at Christie's and supplied wines from him from the trade when he said, you know, we need, say, a Jura wine I knew to go to, well, Loeb as it happened, for the Baudet Chateau Chalon, or Dangeville, which was also Loeb actually at the time. And then the final book, which we did, was the wine book, and worked on with him with this massive scale of vintage chart with things from everywhere. And Richard, his favorite tipple was Glen Morangie. And so we would punish off a lot of Jan Morangi doing this sort of table at one time. A lot of people came to lunches during the course of the book being photographed there. So Elizabeth David and Sybil Bedford and then Jeremiah Tower did the dessert book and so and so. So a lot of people would come and have lunch or supper and so, and food which was cooked, we'd used up some decent wine, so there was a a budget. So, no, it was great fun.
What was Richard Olney like?
He didn't suffer fools gladly. He could be quite quick-tempered if he thought people saying something or doing something was very stupid. I would occasionally, you know, snap. But I got on okay and drove him back when he was closing down the apartment. I stayed out in London. I stuffed the Peugeot estate car with old wine, and we did a sort of leisurely trip down to his place in Solliès, Tucas. And we got to the customs, and I thought, oh, I haven't done anything. No declaration on my honor that this is all my stuff. And then so I thought, oh my God, if they say there's all this wine, there are all these books, there are all these papers, we sort of covered up the wine with the papers and so on. So at that time, you're supposed to do all these declarations if you're moving your stuff. Anyway, we drove straight through and I heaved a sigh of relief. And we got down to Burgundy and had a massive tasting of La Tache. We had supper with Pamela and Aubert that night, and then we drove down to a wonderful lunch. I remember at Ely in Avignon, Ely Lucullus, and he said, you know why this will never make 3 stars? He said, the food. And I said, well, that's ridiculous. He said, well, first of all, he has women servers who were very elegant, sort of elegantly dressed ladies serving. And B, he said, it's on the first floor. And so, you know, you can't have 3 stars with ladies serving and so, and, you know, Michelin won't allow it. And then we got down to Solliès and stayed, and I stayed a few days and so. And the place where he lived was sort of like the cave, and then this sort of a glass-fronted kind of thing and a little garden. And he'd hacked out a cellar in front of the rock. So you went down, you had to be careful of tarantulas or bugs or things and so, which was very cold and damp and wet and so, where he kept his wine. It was very generous. And we went over the next day because Richard didn't drive. So we went over and had lunch at Tompier's, who are really great friends of his, really like second family there.
And he was a good cook, obviously.
Oh, yeah, he was a very good cook. You know, what he said was, keep it simple in terms of, you know, use the best ingredients you've got. Don't try and do sort of really fancy things unless you've got sort of like all the equipment or all the necessary bits and pieces. You cannot do the kind of food, micromanaged, as I call it, without a really full-scale kitchen with sophisticated equipment. You cannot get the same sort of result.
You had met Becky Wasserman in 1983.
Yes, we met at a wine tasting in London. Well, we were in the Cavalry Club or somewhere and a very small room, and we were standing very close together because there was a crowd. We were quite close, and I had a striped shirt and a suit, and maybe a bow tie. I used to wear bow ties because when you were tasting, you didn't dribble it down your tie. Anyway, and so she said she was overcome. She said, I swooned, and the only thing I could say and saw in front of me is, I do like your shirt. So I said, oh, very nice lady, thank you very much. And we talked for a bit, and it's charming. I'd heard a bit about her. And then I knew the next day she was going to be tasting for Daily Telegraph. And I knew she was going back to Burgundy on Thursday. So I thought, oh, very charming lady. So I went to German Street, where by the offices, and bought her a shirt and tie and presented them to her at this tasting in this wine bar in Victoria. She blushed violently. And then we sort of left it at that for a while before we laid on a tasting at Stevensbury's wine bar, which was a disaster because it was so boiling hot that day. And I'd invited Becky because I knew she knew a lot of the people. And so she came, and we had a kiss and a cuddle at one point, but that was it. And then didn't see each other until the following year, I think, when she came to London and she had a tooth abscess, and she was in dire distress. So I took her up to my friend, Howard Ripley. She wouldn't have the tooth out, but she wanted to get back to France to have it taken out. Anyway, she came and stayed with me in the flat, my flat in London. And he said, if it's swollen the next day, come immediately. And her face had joined her shoulder, the end of her shoulder. It was ghastly, so I whisked her up there. He said, I'm going to keep her with me, keep her under observation. So he took her to his home and fed her tomato soup and O'Brien 59. And eventually she went back to France. The next time I think we saw each other was 84, when one of the Lalu Splendid Tastings, and it was Mazzy Chambertin and Laveau Saint-Jacques, of assorted vintages back to the 1930s. And the idea was you had a little booklet and you had to try and guess which was which. And Howard had driven out with me to buy some wine and so and so. And we shared a room at a little hotel called Home. So he went to bed. I got back after this mega tasting, drunk as a skunk, fell into bed and snored away like mad. And the next morning I went into the bathroom and found him asleep in the bath. He said, Russell, you don't know how badly you snore. But not only did I have to practically suffocate myself with a pillow to get rid of your snores, he said, I had to get out of here and so. Anyway, we remained friends forever. And then the next time I said, I'm coming to be inducted into Compagnon de Beaujolais the 21st or 22nd of December. Will you come with me? He said, no, but come for Christmas. So I was dumped by the auto route with half a Stilton and brought up here for Christmas of 84. And that is when we say in your country, we got it on. And I spent Christmas, stayed until her birthday on the 18th, and she went off to the States selling. I came back to England. And then came out on March. Howard drove me out again on a deck chair in the back of the van. And I came with just a large plastic bag carrying clean knickers and trousers. And so she thought, oh my God, he's not going to stay. And I did. And then we got married in 89.
And the witness at the marriage was a older woman who you'd become friends with.
Yes, was Armand Montlidure was my witness, and Michel Lafarge for Becky. Tame one, you know, you say witness, it's like sort of you don't really have a best man, you have witnesses. And she was somebody you got to know, and lovely lady. She died in her 90s, and very feisty, and she used to have these, there was a staircase down into the cellar, which had three sort of things where you had to duck your head. And usually these cellars just have two. But hers had three. And so if she would ask me when we were bringing people around, what nationality is he and so-and-so? If he's British or American and so-and-so, I'll tell them, make sure you don't miss the third one. If they're German, I don't tell them about the third thing that might bonk their heads on. And because she'd had somebody, you know, billeted during the war and everything. And she made the famous remark to a group of young sommeliers who were describing all the fruit essences and flavors and things and so, but don't you smell any grapes? You know wine is made from grapes.
And this is about the time you started to go around and do more tasting in Burgundy.
Yeah. Well, I did quite a bit of tasting with Jean-Pierre, but not to domains. Or not to many domains in the period when I was there from 78 through 81. And then came over here and then started tasting. Well, Dominique Lafont was working just for a while for Becky at that point. And we had customers, mainly Americans and a few Brits. And, you know, you took people around to taste at various domains.
The 80s was really a change period for domain bottled Burgundy.
Yeah, I think that Well, first of all, Pinot Noir became popular, even with Parker touting for heavy over-oaked things, massive stuff. At least the drum was being beaten for Pinot Noir, even if, you know, a lot of the things were not particularly to my taste or not to our taste. At least, you know, as a lot of people say about Parker, he did publicize booze. Because I remember, you know, it was hard going back in selling Burgundy because it wasn't Bordeaux. It wasn't easy. It wasn't considered simple. And there were a lot of sort of variations. And so people really didn't know what to buy or to put on or so and so. And only a few really well-educated sommeliers or buyers or so and so who knew what the real goodies were.
What are some of the key cellar visits that you remember over that 30-year period?
Well, it's always fun to go to Romani Conti, Lafarge. We always got something nice to drink at the end. Pustoy always used to sort of phase you by producing things like the half bottles of 66. You'd finish having drunk a sort of 1990 a Bustor, and then you go and you drink a 66 half bottle of Centenay Gravier or the Taverne and so, which would be extraordinary because it would be so good, so young, that you just were groping in the dark in terms of trying to guess the vintage. There was a wonderful old character called André Moussy in Pommard, and that was absolutely a splendid visit always. The wines were quite rustic. And so, but we sold them quite well for a time, we would say, really sort of old-fashioned. Had the most incredible hands. They were sort of like size of meat plates, but really sort of gnarled. Poor bastard had been captured at the beginning of the war and ended up in Russia. He didn't come back from Russia until 47, prisoner in sort of East Germany and then Russia or whatever. Splendid old character. Becky took him and his wife too. We went on a trip to the States, and we got down to Los Angeles. We went to Spargo's. I think it was my birthday or thing. And here was this guy, really sort of, you know, red, chiseled sort of features, in a black leather sort of jacket. And of course, the paparazzi thought, this old guy's got to be one of the stars of the stage and screen and so and so. And he said, "What are they doing?" I said, "Well, you look so mediatic," and so he said, "Oh, I don't think so." That was a thing. There was a wonderful old character called Mademoiselle Pitoise Irena in Meursault, and she was quite a large, substantial woman, and she had this tiny little dog, and there was a big notice saying, "Beware of the dog." And so when you looked around, out came this large woman, you looked around, the dog was about the size of her foot. Tiny little thing and so beware of the dog was total joke. And she made some bits and pieces of stuff, and then her brother took over the domain. La Fontaine, as I remember, used to be incredibly, before they changed the cellar, it was the coldest bloody place on the face of the earth, a really brass monkey cellar, practically icicles hanging off the wall. And the other place was the funny one with Ponceau, who used to sell the old man Ponceau, not Laurent. And he had cellars which were, there were some down in the village, close to the village. But the first time I went to visit one of those sort of Burgundian things, I said, "My wonderful French, où on se trouve Monsieur Ponceau?" And the guy pointed sort of behind, he was down in the square in the village, and said, "Oh, it's up by the old walnut tree." So I drove up and drove up. Couldn't see an old walnut tree or any tree at all. So I drove down again. So the other guy said, "You told me to look for an old walnut tree, and can you describe the house more? Because there doesn't appear to be a tree up there." I said, "Well, it's a sort of long house," and so like that. And I said, "Oh, when I got up there, there was a stump where the old walnut tree had been." And the guy had obviously not been up there for 1,000 years because he knew it was up where the old walnut tree was. And that was the very cold cellar. And then there's another character also in Morissette, and he called Castagnier, who farmed the, he married Madame Betty. He was a Pied Noir from North Africa, a very strong accent, and I'd got to know him. And being foreign, you learn to sort of listen very hard when everybody's speaking French with accent. And I went the first time with a friend here called Jean-Yves Devevey. And he said, I don't understand a word he's saying. Can you translate for me? So here is an Englishman translating for a Frenchman who spoke sort of with a very strong accent from North Africa. He had a slew of really, really good wines. Chris Newman inherited them from his father. And he had Mazzy Chambertin, a lot of Grand Cru. And we were selling those until the early 90s. And he was a character. Écoute, Jojo, don't make wine for the short term. So these are Grand Cru, and they should be Grand.
You would have known Angel, right, in Von Romane?
Yes. Oh, he was very special. And if he was in the mood, we would start with the current vintage and then work back through to sometimes the 1900 ones or twos we've had. It's the only time I've had 44, well, no, twice I've had 44 Louis Saint-Georges from Gouges and 44 Vougeot from Angèle. But he used to, you go back by decades, so he was born in 55, so an absolutely fabulous 55 Clos Vougeot. And then you go back 40-something, whatever was there, 49 or 47, and select something. And then something from the 30s, something in the 20s, 23 or something, I remember on one occasion. And then something like a 17 or a 15 or something. There was this one friend who played the mouth organ who was in the wine trade. I'd been a salesman up in New York, and he got the mouth organ going, and that got Phil Angel popping those corks. Becky knew that I would be back late with whoever was coming for supper if it was a Angel tasting. And to me, it was one of the, he was a very special guy, quite quiet, but very, sort of, you'd think he was very serious, but was sort of really kindly underneath. He died too young.
Did you ever taste a Comte Vogue?
Yes, not until the new order came in 1990, 89, 90, and so. I used to buy old De Vogue wines, which were quite cheap, if they were in mixed lots at Christie's. And I bought a Magnum of the 45. This is going back to 1968. A Magnum of the 45 from De Vogue for, it was £10. English money back then at Nicolas were doing one of their Christmas sales. And I bought a Magnum of La Mission Aubryon and a Magnum of De Vogue Vievin in Musigny back then, a ridiculous price. And so, it was magnificent. But they were always, there was a wonderful 47, 52, 53. There was a period in Christie's when if you bought mixed lots, nobody wanted mixed lots. And if it was assorted, you know, even DRC and so, I remember a mixed case, not of Remy Conti, but other things. And it went for not very much money. And I used the Echezo 55 to make a gravy because it was slightly oxidized.
And I assume you know Francois Jobard.
Yes. Very much so. Started tasting there a long time. And what's changed is that he used to keep wine in cask much longer than now. And the style has changed quite a lot. You know, modern punchy minerality as opposed to rather sort of softer and just different sort of softer wines.
And you met Jasper Morris?
I think I probably gave a wine lecture to Jess Morris when he was still at Oxford, running one of the wine circles. He worked for a man after Oxford called Johnny Goodhouse, and he worked at Goodhouse in King's Road, and I went there, and Jasper was there stacking the shelves. And then he set up his own company, which was down near Victoria Station. I actually started buying off him. I remember buying off him Bonazzo 47 from, was it Chateau de Fell or somebody like that? Absolutely fabulous. It was very cheap, and I bought it, and then he was embarrassed because he thought he had much more and said, "You really hogged the best wine of the thing." And I said, "Well, I'm not going to buy anything but the very best, Jasper. I am supporting your fledgling company. After all, you should be thankful."
Clive used to come over a lot. Clive Coates, right?
Clive, when he discovered that I was living here with Becky, said, "Well, you don't mind putting me up, do you?" And so for a long time would come and use this place as his bed and breakfast, or bread, breakfast and dinner, while writing the vine, doing the vine.
There was an infamous tasting with you, Clive Coates, and Freddie, right?
Oh, yeah. No, that was when Clive was doing his book on Burgundy. We went along to Lalu to do verticals of Volnay-Sontenot, Clos de Milieu, and Mazy Chambertin. And she'd put the bottles on barrels, like sort of 4 or 5 yards inside this cellar. And we were tasting away and so and so. And at that time, she had Freddie, who was an extremely vocal, who was sort of very crotchety, to say the least, and who was always yapping.
This is her dog.
This is dog Freddie. She always used to find dogs by the side of the road and adopt them on her way back. There was Basil, who then came later, was a floppy sort of spaniel, and on her way back from Monaco or whatever. And Freddie was one of these adopted things, and Freddie was a sort of scruffy tailor. Anyway, I smelt it first, and so moved away up into the cellar. And Clive was saying, "This one is on a very heavy reduction." And that is absolute nonsense, Clive. You don't know what you're talking about, and so and so. And then suddenly, "Oh, Freddie, naughty boy, Freddie." And so we had to sort of evacuate for a while the oily cloud left by Freddie was allowed to dissipate.
And when did you visit Malm?
Mid-90s, because we bought some 93s. And it was the stinkiest, filthiest cellar I've seen ever, with mold and water puddles and things. And knowing him to be professor of enology at Dijon, thought this very surprising, that this thing. But the wines are quite good and tough and so and so.
So how do you like to taste red Burgundy? Because you're a real good taster.
Well, first of all, I don't like tasting red wine in barrel before malolactic's finished. I don't like it because I find that the first impression I get of a wine sticks with me. So if I go to a cellar and it's, or one's still in mallow, one isn't, etc., etc., I find it very hard to evaluate. And secondly, I much prefer that the wine has finished and maybe has had a racking. If it hasn't had a racking, then it's, you know, been left sort of completely so that it's like spring. I will taste happily in April and May, by which time, you know, the wine has gone through one winter. Or even better, when it's like the next autumn, so to taste when it's had, you know, a full year. Obviously, you get a general sort of impression of the vintage and the wines and so, but to actually say, you know, this wine is, I mean, one of the most fascinating things, having tasted a lot at Fred Meunier, is how the wine went up and down, up and down, up and down, and sometimes tasting, you know, 3 times or 4 times in the space of 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, to notice the differences there. And how he was saying, "I'll tear the rest of my hair out soon because I can't get a handle on it." Well, the other thing is, when they're freezing cold, I find it very difficult to taste. So that's the main thing. Just basically, I'd like to taste the wine a year old before then pontificating as to whether it's going to be good or not.
And what about the Burgundy vintages that you remember?
Oh, the great ones I've had. We once had the 1864 at Pommard Clos des Epineaux, but that was exceptional. But the Pommard 15, a 23 Richebourg, but then later we were lucky to find some 37 Becky's vintage of the Auspice from Giroux. I had that on a number of occasions. It was a really good and a really sort of firm vintage. And then post-war 45, 47, 49. 49 seems had less, but it's sort of like the perfect child. And then I like 53. As I say, I remember it from the dustbins. And 59, 62, really good, underrated, much better than 61. 64, 66, I like 69. I fight with Becky over this one because I think it was okay. 78. 80s, 83 turned out much better, but 85 is my, I think is perfect. People were rude about it at the time. They said it was no acidity, it wouldn't last. And I think 85, you know, it's been well cellared and so it's still perfect. 88 for Tuffy. 91, 93. 90 is curious in it hasn't lived up to the great expectations. It's all right, but, and then 99, pretty good. In the 2000s, 05, and they're still not really ready, the better ones. 2007, I think, is pleasant. 09, still unready.
It seems like certain villages have become a little more esteemed in the market, at least the American market, since you were here in the 80s. It seems like Volnay and Maurice Saint-Denis, people talk about them more now.
Back then on the English market, I mean, going way back, the wines that we could sell when it first started back in the late 60s and so, people wanted Alex Corton, Nuit, and in Côte de Beaune, it would be Pommard. And it's been a complete switch. Volnay, you couldn't sell it, was considered a wimp. And Chambon-Mussigny the same. Maurice Saint-Denis, nobody knew what the hell it was about. You know, Chambertin, every Chambertin has always been pretty good. But if you were looking at sort of other things, people, certainly on the English market, there was much more for rather butch toughies rather than smooth and sexy. And that's been a complete sort of bolt fast of popularity. And now Pommard is relatively difficult. People are leery of Pommard because they think it might be too tough. And Volnay has certainly sort of creamed the reputation of Pommard.
It seems like in general, the ideal for red Burgundy these days is a little more elegant and fine, whereas it used to be a little more heavy in the popular imagination, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. The English palate for Burgundy, not sort of high-end, tended to be based on butch claret. And so if it wasn't butch like claret and rather tough and tannic, I mean, look at the way same things happen with Bordeaux. It's completely de-tannicized itself. And the same way that people would look for big, vigorous Burgundies back in that period. And now we're actually getting real Burgundy, much less sort of doctored stuff. It's not being beefed up by the Vin de Médecin or things. People, you know, have been weaned to proper Burgundy, which is smoother and sexier. I think that one of the things that people have left things to ripen more.
So you were in Burgundy in that period of time where there was a lot of change generationally, winemaking styles. What really surprised you over that?
To me, the biggest change has been the use of the sorting table. You know, they're all sort of the oxidation effect and whether that was corks or whether it was vertical presses, I don't know. There's so many theories on that. The one thing is that now people do try and put the healthy grapes in and not the mixture that used to be. The green ones for acidity, the moldy ones for the sugar, and the ripe ones for the wine. You know, the tripartite sort of thing for... And that was when people were producing lots of shit for the merchants, the négociants, who were then going to correct it with the vin de médecin, with stuff from Chateau Neuf or down south or whatever, North Africa. And so now people are doing that. Everybody's cleaned up. Everybody's very careful not to F up a clean wine. I mean, you look back, okay, in the time that I do, 50, you look at disastrous vintages. There seem to be fewer disasters, but you look at the 60s, 63, 65, 68, a total disaster. In the 70s, 75, 72 is pretty acidic, but it, you know, then it turned out better. 77 was ugly. In the 80s, which is an ugly vintage, a poor vintage, is 84, but not horrendous. And then in the 90s, again, I don't know what you'd consider the most horrendous vintage of the 90s. There really hasn't been one. No really atrocious weather, except recently, you know, there's been the 11, 12, 13, 14 period. Vintages have been very scarce rather than unripe or totally unripe or totally unsaleable.
You like a good distillate. And when I first came here, you told me some thoughts about Borgogna distillates in terms of what were the good ones and why.
I think you need fine rather than Mar. Mar always remains like distilled old boots, leather boots, because that's just the smell, or grappa, the same sort of thing. You can get incredibly good fine. The finest is actually, I believe, from white wine, and Pierre Maurier's fine de Bourgogne is just brilliant and will rival a lot of cognacs.
The key there is white grapes, not red.
I think so.
I feel like one of the changes when I talk with you about wine is that some of the other regions of France are making better wine or more interesting wine than they used to make when you were starting your career.
There's much better stuff on the Loire. I used to sort of really hate Vouvray's and Semur's and things. I think basically because people used to pump so much sulfur in that they were not really nice. And the other sort of passion wine-wise would be, you know, good Sauternes, but then it's so out of fashion that nobody even bothers to think about it, unfortunately. And the wine that I, in the world, that I loved the best was port, but anything now post-1970 to me is like a sort of ruby or tawny without having any depth or character. Whereas when I was pinching it as a small boy, a smallish boy, from the decanter, it had what I called a cough mixture taste. And when I got to start tasting vintage ports until 77, they had this cough mixture taste. And post that time, everything I taste now has been sort of like smoothed up for quick consumption. You no longer have sort of massive black strap port that needed time to throw a crust and be kept 20 years before you even started looking at it to see whether how it was coming along. The perfect vintage after the war was 48, much better than 45s because a lot of them were bottled badly. And really good 48 Taylor Fonseca and Graham. The 47s were too hot, so faded. And after that you have 55, but really then 63. And very nice 60, 66, and so can be still very nice, and 70. But after 70, forget it. People say 77 is going to be wonderful, but it's not.
When did Marc de Grazia show up?
Marco, we met in 1988 when we went to Piedmont because we'd never been. And under the auspices of Marco, we tasted Clerico, Scovino, Altari, all the Barolo boys that he had. And so we had a great time and remained great friends ever since.
What was Domenico Clerico like back then?
Oh, splendid. He spoke Piemontese, he would not speak. And he and I would converse somehow. Becky would say, I don't understand what he's saying. And Marco would say, I don't understand what he's saying half the time. But he and Russell seemed to get on terribly well. A very, very warm and wonderful person. Known as Leone, the lion, because he was quite dramatic. And fought off cancer twice. And then, you know, they had this tragedy with their daughter who died.
When did Rusty Staub come along?
Rusty came about 20 years ago, or 21 years ago, 86-ish. And then, you know, we made friends, and then he started coming back. And then gradually, when he sort of got going with the, I'm not sure when the auction started, he would come and spend time with us. And we would organize the tastings for him of the various people who he bought from. And then would stay here with us and so on. So we had to, his breathing got very difficult. He had to sleep in a chair, sleep upright. So he had a big armchair that he slept in and just became a very good friend. And occasionally we've been on trips with him. We went to Piedmont with him and come and the thing, go on a jaunt with him. Became a very good friend, very close. He was an amazing character. And the joke we had is that he was born another 44. He was born on the 1st of April, and I was born on the 25th. So on the 1st of April, he would call up and say, you've now got to call me sir for the next 3 weeks. So I would say, aye, aye, sir, aye, aye, sir. And then call up on the 25th. Now you can stop calling me sir. Mon frère, he used to call me mon frère. And died just a few days before his birthday last year. Big gap to everybody. And one of the most amazing things, and I still get tearful when I think about it, was after 9/11, because he was in our building down there in the battery next to the things. And when it happened, he said, I started running. And I ran all the way uptown and didn't stop with the, you know, debris and so-and-so floating around me and choking the air.
Russell Hone went from food rationing to allocated burgundy. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, sir.
Russell Hone, the aubergiste of Becky Wasserman Company.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Scala has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's ILLDrinktothatPOD.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening.
I'd like to thank Becky Wasserman and Russell, who welcomed me to their home while I conducted this interview. It meant a lot to me on a personal level, and it allowed this interview to happen. Could you do some impressions for us?
Do some Irish, if you like. Well, if you think of drink, you got to drink a lot of drink while you're thinking of it. And if you don't think of drink while you're drinking it, it's a shame because you can't describe it later. When you're completely blotted, when you've gone over the top and you're out for the count. And they say, well, what was the drink like? And they said, well, I don't remember because I didn't have enough of it.
Can you do Liverpool?
No, Liverpool's a bit like that. You know, I was a Beatle once in my old days. But the nastiest accent in England is Birmingham. I'm from Birmingham and I think it's terrific, this wine, but it's red. I don't like red wine. I think it should be brown or yellow or white even. Depends on the meal. You know, you get some sauternes with your scampi and chips. Lovely.
Did you ever meet any East Enders, London East End?
Oh, hang about. Russell, he's a good boy, that Russell. You've got to take him. He comes to our garage. He comes in and he says, I want a car done over. Spark plugs renewed. I don't have his spark plugs in stock. So what I do is I squirt WD and say, you got your new plugs, Russell. That'll cost you 20 quid.
Do you ever meet any Welsh people?
Oh, look, you die, Bach. Oh, down the valleys. It's where they sing all the time.
Ever meet any Oxford Dons?
Yeah, this wine's absolutely darling, wouldn't you say, George?